Okay. We had some sound problems because I want to play a little video a little later on, and the video that plays off my machine and the amplification here of the microphone there in very different ranges. I think probably an order of magnitude different, and so they have to handle that in the back. Marcel was saying that we have an interdisciplinary seminar, and myself, my own work is in some way not localizable because it's spread across very different disciplines. I started out as a scientist, my first training, but then began to start issues of knowing and learning in mathematics and science. But mostly focusing on mathematical representation within the sciences. And so I've followed, because I started out as a high school teacher, where I videotaped students learning math and science, I then followed people at work, scientists, field ecologists, biologists in their labs, fish culturists in the fish hatchery, electrician at the job, and I found myself, because I was interested in issues of learning, I focused more on a genetic perspective. And I often wondered whether what we take to be signs, what their function is when people don't know the sign yet. And so I became interested in this very topic, namely tracking the origin of signs in mathematical activity. And over the course of the last 20 years, I ended up somewhere, I got into reading some of the very interesting French philosophers, one from the late 18th and beginning 19th century, and early Pierre Mendebiran, and a 20th century philosopher who basically reads Mendebiran on the emergence or the origin of science. And that's what I wanted to present this morning in connection with some real data from the work that I have been conducting. But at the same time, I want to sort of set it in perspective. I don't see Raphael. I have some okay. I have some images too from a chapter that he wrote in a book that I edited on learning mathematics. So, I think it kind of started when I was reflecting about the talk that I would be giving here. I was thinking about an event that happened early in my academic career, where a colleague and I, we looked at professors lecturing science at the university, and one of them was a physics professor, and the physics professor eventually in his talk he talked to future elementary teachers, and he does this gesture about something, and we tested the students later. We found out that they didn't understand. They had no clue what the professor was talking about. Well, he talked about the escape velocity from the Earth, and when the velocity is large enough, then you get a trajectory of the object like this. The interesting thing for us was that initially we had this conversation, and when we referred to the professor and his lecture, we did this. Basically providing an iconic sign of a repetition of what the professor had done, this gesture. But in the course of our analysis, a change happened. Namely, this no longer stood for what the professor was doing, but it stood in our conversations for people who sit in lectures and have no clue what is going on. And clearly, a shift has occurred, because now this had an no longer the iconic relation to what had happened, but an arbitrary relation to some other phenomenon related. Yeah. Anyway, I became interested in this emergence of science. And it happened that at the beginning of the between 2000 and 2005, I spent 5 years in a science laboratory, and these scientists, biologists, they prepared these slides where they basically spread some retina onto a microscopic slide, and they look at the slide under a microscope. Later on, they use the computer screen, and they also look at some signal that is coming off these, because the scientists, they want to measure how much light is absorbed. So they look at these graphs, but in order to know what the graph is representing, they need to know what is on the slide. But in order to know what's on the slide, what they're looking at, they need to know what the graph is. So it takes, at least, it took a number of months before they could look at the graph and see what's on the slide, and look at the slide and see what will be on the graph. So what we have originally there's not a signified relationship, because this relationship doesn't exist at all. It evolves over time as the scientists become enabled to make matches between particular features of this wiggle on the one hand, and particular features of this messy stuff on the other hand. So for me, these became much more interesting phenomena than conversations about signs that are already fixed and that we can accept as such. So in the part of my work, I became interested in genetic perspectives, and the genetic perspectives are very different. Just to mention a name, the Russian social psychologist Vygotsky, he takes a genetic perspective on cognition, and basically not only on learning over periods of time, but also moment to moment, so that he will say, and that's what I want to come back to at the very end, that he will say that thought is not, that speech is not premised by thought, but that that the speakers discover thoughts in their own expressions. And thereby he takes a Merleau-Pontian perspective that Merleau-Ponty also had been taking. So the question of communication and the question of the sign, of course, depends on the perspective that you take on cognition. And so there is a relationship between communication and cognition. In fact, a colleague of mine, Anna Spart, she created a new concept of commocognition to bring communication and cognition together. The theories that I was interested in communication are those that combine language with other forms, just as George and Raphael got interested in gestures. David McNeil has a particular model that operates such that you have an underlying unit, and it's within this unit that you have different modalities of expression, and these different modalities, they stand in a contradictory relationship, and McNeil explicitly refers to Vygotsky and his dialectical approach. Other people like Ali Bali and Golden Meadow, they suppose that there might be two underlying cognitive models, and one expresses itself in gesture and the other one in talk, such that during growth, during developmental periods, you might have a child talking at the conceptual level that is lower than the gestures that are at a higher conceptual level. And that's what Martha and Susan argue that you can actually recognize growth potential because there's a contradiction between what children say and what they gesture, and the gestures, they argue, at least in their earlier work, that they that shows growth potential. And then there are other people like Hadar and Butterworth. They say gestures, they are just they serve, for example, excitational functions, so that if you gesture, then you increase your brain potential, and that makes that prepares the words to come out. So these are kind of interesting theories. And then, of course, you have embodiment theories, and George Lakoff is sitting here, and Raphael is coming later on, and Johnson. And fundamentally, it is based on a schema theory that Johnson, in his 87 book, directly links to Kant. And when I was looking at the critiques of Lakoff and Johnson's work that came from the mathematics community, for example, in the review that Science published, I was trying to understand where these mathematicians come from. And I assume that one of the things that I detected, and I want to show that to you in a little quote, may be that gestures are not actually necessary precursors of mathematical thought, but they're sort of correlated with mathematical thought. And it might be quite evident if you have schema that operate, and gestures are one of an expression of pre-existing schema, then the gestures are actually not necessary in the way that I see that you and Raphael want to argue, namely that you have the, bodily knowledge that is a precursor of higher forms or higher conceptual forms that are achieved through metaphorization. So, okay, where am I? Yeah, I have an example. Oh, I don't. God, I don't see my cursor here. I have to go back. Okay. View, present the tool. Okay, so now I'll go here. This is one of the examples that Raphael uses in the chapter, where he looks at the mathematician Gershon Harel, who is giving a lecture, I think, to future teachers of mathematics. And Raphael writes, as he, namely Gershon Harel, says, increasing, he gestures with his right hand palm down with a wavy upward diagonal movement slightly along the line y equal x. The gesture is co-produced with the enactment of the source path goal schematic notion, where the source corresponds to a generic location somewhere down here with low positive values of x and fx. The goal of the instantiated schema corresponds to a generic location up, with greater values for both x and fx. The trajectory is indexed by the external edge of the hand. And the trajectory, the path, is the trace left by the motion of the hand that is indexing the increasing values of the function as x gets increasingly greater values. Now, you see, central to this presentation is the a particular schema, namely here, it's the source path goal schema. There are, however, very different approaches to the relation between the talk and the form of gesture, and one comes, for example, from Michel Henry, a French philosopher who died earlier this last decade. He writes also about gestures. In the original phenomenon of the act of tracing a curve in space, with my index finger, the movement of my gaze that follows the index finger, that constitutes the spatial figure of the curve, it's the same as the movement of my hand. It's the same as the movement of my hand, which traces the curve. And the unity of the two movements, which are but one, is an ontological unity. It is a unity in the absolute immanence of subjectivity. Here, the theme of thought is the visual image of the curve, which is the transcendent object of my look, but also the subjective movement of my hand that traces such a curve, which touches it, so to speak, and which creates it. The theme, or more simply, the terminus of the movement of my hand is therefore not at all kinesthetic impression. It's not kinesthetic impression. The latter is absent from the central and original phenomenon constituted by the subjective movement and its transcendent correlate. And it's the absence of that we wanted to mark by declaring that the impression was unconscious. For Michel Henry, what is fundamental is a movement, but this movement is not described by a schematic notion before. It's an immanent power out of which, or which I will later say, a doubling of which will lead into the kind of signifier-signified relationship that we understand as the function of a sign. So, in my work, following Michel Henry, I actually call it the incarnation of mathematics, or mathematics in the flesh, in a more recent book, but not quite in the way that you do it, because it is based on an idea of the flesh, which European philosophers, Germans, they call light, and the French call it chair, which is opposed to the body that we have. In English, we only have the body, and it makes no distinctions between very different functions of the body. For Henri and Mendebiran, at the very, very origin is movement, just as for Maxine Sheets Johnson, who has looked a bit critical at the work that George and Raphael had done. So Mendebiran, he postulates an internal space that arises from a power to act. And that provides the origin of habits. And I think he is very close to the Russian neuroscientist Alexander Luria, who talks about motion that are not a premise upon the existence of a schema, but the power of which is immanent to the execution of the movement itself. So, what I'd like to do now is take a look at the video of a physics professor. And what you will see in real time, a talk. What you will observe is there are lots of pauses and stumbling and mumbling. I will show 2 minutes and then excerpt 32 seconds that I have in slides of transcripts with all the pauses and lots of pictures so that we can take a closer look in slower time. And then in my next step, I'd like to propose or articulate a way of understanding how movement can self-affect its prior to any sign, that meaning signifier-signified relation, and then how through a process of doubling we can get to the sign, and this process of doubling we can also describe using catastrophe-theoretic notions. That's sort of the trajectory that I'd like to take now. So, we have a physics professor here, close to 40-year veteran, He lectures a third-year university course on the magnetocaloric effect. Fundamentally, it is the effect that the physicists use to cool substances down to close to absolute zero. And the effect works by applying a magnetic field and then turning it off, and then by isolating it, the substance, and letting it exchange with the environment, you get an alignment of molecules. And as these molecules get out of alignment, they take up energy, and this energy comes from the substance itself, leading to a cooling. And this is basically the effect that the professor is talking about in this 2-minute clip. He already had done so during the last period, during the last lecture, at the very end. And then he had to close. And his last words in that previous lecture were, I think I got something wrong. And you will see something similar happen here. And that's what makes, to me, what makes it interesting, because you don't see this fluid performance, which really makes invisible the work of lecturing, the work of cognition. So like many others, like for example, in ethnomethodology or phenomenology, I'm interested in those moments where the normal processes that make life so easy and the work invisible, where that work comes out. So let's take a look at this 2-minute clip, and I hope that the sound is strong enough. We tried it earlier. So the physics professor, in this part, he will produce a graph, and we follow him through that production of a graph until he turns away and moves on to the next step. I don't hear the...
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Can you hear enough? Yeah. Can you hear that? We'll stop it, and I see the. Stop it, and they'll try to get the sound up. Okay, we'll try it again.
Oh yes, since we are doing an isothermal process followed by an adiabatic isentropic D process, we could get some insight into it by on an interesting temperature diagram. And I said that schematically, suppose the entropy varies with temperature, something like that. When there's no field, and something like that, when there is a field, then the exhaust process, when you put the material in a magnetic field at constant temperature, it's just like that. And when you when you then adiabatically demagnetize it expands, and so the temperature is lower. And then I said, by the time you get to here, when you put it in the magnetic field, by the time you get to here, when you put it in the magnetic field, there, and then when you demagnetize it,
I think I said there was something wrong with that picture.
see a little later on what if anything is wrong with it. In the meantime, I want to talk about the Nernst heat theorem and the
He presents this phenomenon. If you notice, there are long pauses. He walks across back and forth the stage. He stands there, and the hand goes all over the place before he actually puts down the line that is the next part of a process that he is in the process of representing. So, what I'm showing in the paper that I sent Marcel is that there's a lot of gesturing going on, but it's almost to gloss a searching kind of gesture. It's not something like that's prefigured and then goes out, but it's out of these hand movements that you then get the actual representational gesture. And why might I think that this is occurring? Well, because I observed something similar in high school students, where the students, when you ask them, what did you do in your experiments, when the teacher asked, what did you do in your, what did you find out in your experiment, the student said, look. The teacher says, no, explain to me. The students, look. And they do the hand motions again, what they had done before. And then during that same lesson, the students are asked six times for an explanation. And what you observe is that in the course of being asked over and over again, they have an increasing number of gestures, and no longer with the experiment as a background, but now, for example, a pencil replacing a rod in the experiment. And then the representational form, the gesture, is becoming more and more abstract, describing, for example, a movement of electrons and no longer a movement of objects. So what we can see, what I believe is occurring here, that signs are in the process of being born. They're just forming. They're not already there as forms of expressions, as a way of doing a memory dump, but as a way of, they're in the process of being formed. So let's take a look at the first part. So this begins in the middle of this 2-minute segment, and he goes, and when you, then there's a pause of 0.95 seconds. Ooh, that when you, then oh, and you see that from 0 to 4, he just produces when you, but when you, and a long pause. And then he articulates something that belongs the physical aspect, namely adiabatically. I capitalize only those things that are sort of emphasized, because as part of my work, and in addition to what many others do with gestures, I also focus on prosody, meaning on speech intensity, speech rates, on the pitch level, because they are part. They also have signifying function, although it's different. It's not in the conscious in the same way that, for example, the physics and the mathematical content. Then when you go to here, E, F, G, there's the gesture that he does. In this case, there's the gesture that follows just or at the end of the adiabatically, and David McNeil, he might say that you have here a relationship between the conceptual content at the verbal level and the gestural content. What is important to look for is whether the stroke, the main part of the gesture, overlaps with the conceptual part. And there was a big debate in the 80s and 90s about the relationship between gesture and talk. And some of my own work has showed that in learners, you might have a delay of 2 or more seconds between the gestural part and the conceptual part articulated verbally. You see that another aspect of interest is then the next step, that comes in line three, where at first you have the gesture, then you have the hand movement to find the right location here, and then he actually draws the line, but it's no longer directly iconic, it's actually in reverse, the movement is in reverse, and then he enacts the gesture again here, and it's parallel to that one. And then the next step in the production of this of the graph comes where he has to place another process, which is isothermal. And this process, this line takes the production of it takes from here 12 seconds. So it takes him, as you will see in the following slide, 12 seconds before he actually puts down this line. The next line in the process, he hasn't even started. You come here, you see him finally in this age and I, he produces the next line. So if you come back up, you see that before this is produced, there are long pauses. And this one, there was already a pause on the preceding slide, 0.32 seconds. Sorry. Then you come here, there's another 1.3, so it's 1.6 seconds. And then production of interjections on 0.44 seconds. Then you have another 2.25 seconds before, and then I said by the time you get to here, then there is another long pause of over 2 seconds when you put it in a magnetic field, and then he will produce it. What we see here, I think, is very different from the kind of presentation that I showed you earlier that Rafael Nunez had in his presentation of the mathematician. Because when you look at this presentation and the text that Rafael accompanies, you can easily see that there is a schema being enacted. There are no pauses. It's just as if the math professor reads it out. In this particular situation, there's not just the reading out of something that pre-exists. Some, in science education, people often say some formal cognitive structure that is just read out. Or an alternative would be to say that there is some existing structure understanding that is being read out, but it is somehow decaying in the production. And my tendency is to suggest that the pragmatic aspect of the production of a lecture like this, of the pragmatic production of the science, that is where we have to start our cognitive theories from, not from the ideal case where we have some Kantian schema that is merely enacted one after the other. Okay, so in my work, I focus on these kind of things where the production is not just coming out, even though I'm dealing with experienced, in this case, physics professors. And I observe the same when I have physics professors look at first year, second year university graphs from first year and second year university courses. In many cases, the physics professors cannot read, interpret these graphs from first year courses in their own field. And the same among biologists, we gave them graphs from the first year, second year courses of their own field, and they could not interpret it, like 1 out of 7. Four, and now I have to distinguish, research scientists who are not directly working in the field, university professors who lecture first and second year courses, they had statistically significantly higher number of correct on the problems that we provided them with. Now, how can we explain that? And I want to suggest now a genetic kind of model that of the sign, whereby the sign arises from a moment when there were no signs. So this is the Saussure's representation of the sign, where you have arbre, the French word for a tree, and the tree, the sign forms a unit, and for the Saussure you have the signifier and the signified. But the signifier and signified could also be a concept and the word, or a concept and the tree. So it doesn't necessarily have to be an external representation, it could also be an internal. But his work has been questioned, or that presentation of the sign has been questioned in the latter part. In the latter part of the 20th century, by a series of scholars, including Lacan, Nancy, Henri, and so on. And fundamentally, you have a signifier and a over the signified, but the signifier can never attain, so to speak, the signified. And Nancy and Lacoulabart, they say that it is the bar which separates the two stages of the signifier and the signified, which is the primordial. This bar, Nancy and Labarthe suggest, is the signifier of the very lack of the sign in its origin. This is the signifier without which all the others would represent nothing. And so, in the later 20th century phenomenological philosophical approaches, you will get an approach to the sign which is allied with the program of doing first philosophy. How does it get started? And you will find these ideas in Heidegger, for example, who thinks about the notion between a being with a small b, namely scientis in French, étant, and being sign with the capital B. This unfolding where living beings come to articulate and understand themselves using forms of representation, this beginning has to be theorized. And for Husserl, he made it quite clear in his exposition of retention and protension that we need representation. We need to have the capability of making the present present again in order for us to have sign, to do thinking, and anything of that nature. Now, how can we think that origin? And I think that that in this French philosopher, Maine de Biran, you already have a dialectical approach that you can also find in dialectical materialist approaches. For example, when Ilyenkov, a Russian philosopher, talks about or discusses Marx's notion of value, which is the relation of a commodity to itself rather than to another commodity. So there's a self relation that Nancy and Lacoulabart see in this separator. And you will find the same idea in the Russian psychologist Vygotsky, who is one of the leading developmental psychologist cited in the educational literature right now, even though he's not well understood, I think, especially his ideas about thinking that arises from some undeveloped nucleus, undifferentiated nucleus, which he understands as the general, and which articulates itself as thought unfolds. And this is how I'd like to see this lecture, namely as not a pre-finished thought that somehow finds its way outside, but a thought in the making. And so we can see thought in the making. Luria and Sheets Johnston, they're talking about archetypal movements that are at the origin. And these archetypal movements are forms of immanent knowing rather than or the knowledge is immanent to the exercise of the movement rather than an application of a schema. So, let me go here to the next slide. Okay. If you have, you could have, and this is how I represent the Luria's and Sheets Johnston's idea of some movement that, think about the physics professor who goes, and his hand goes left and right, and goes like this movement, then, and then if there's a fine line, and then eventually he draws the next line. So his hands go back up, go around, and then find their place, I'm glossing, find their place, and then become a signifying movement. And this is precisely what Sheets Johnston and Henri and others suggest, namely that there are original, that there are movements, but they are not yet schema that are associated with them. Vygotsky has an example that he uses about how children learn to gesture. They're not pointing, I want this. Vygotsky uses examples to suggest that out of the unfocused hand movement of the child, parents will select the one and reinforce the one that then becomes collectively understood sign for I want this, or a pointing gesture, a pointing to something. So initially there is movement. The movements of the child have no meaning. They have no signifier signified relation. They're not yet signs. But it's the parents that select among all those movements that the child makes and reinforce those that that already exist as collectively understood signs. And this, I think, introduces a dimension, a cultural or societal dimension that we don't often see, for example, being articulated or being articulated in very different ways in the embodiment literature. So the link, it's not just that we know with our bodies. We need to make explicit in our models how culture comes in, how that body is a cultural body through and through. Let me show you the next, how I then think what happens. If you had an archetypal movement, then you can, which is the knowledge of which is imminent to its execution, you just have one. You have something that's not even a sign because it only refers to itself. So in order to have a sign function, we need a doubling. You need what phenomenological philosophers refer to as the ecstasis. Something that's standing out and then can refer back to the movement. Some form of image, Mendeberan says. Now, how might such a doubling come about? And you see it already indicated. We would need some kind of bifurcation point because without that, we're nowhere. We're still at a moment of pre-humans, where there's interactions with the environment, but not intentional in interactions of the kind that require making the present again. And you know that it is because you can have a sound like dog, but it's only when we hear that sound dog as a repeatable sound that it actually can refer to something else. And I wish that more people concerned with science were trying to transcribe videotape that are recorded under difficult situation. Because you're listening, and you have no clue what's being said. The best you can do is there's a human voice, but you don't know. And then sometimes someone suggests, oh, that this person is saying dog, or this person is saying that, and you listen and you say, oh yeah, it's there. But you cannot. And so this noise that you're hearing has no signifying function because you don't hear what is being said. So, but as soon as it has, we get this, we get a relation as we have here, some form of image that refers back to the archetypal movement. And we might ask, well, how can this be a model? And I showed in a paper basically that you can use catastrophe theory to model development of the human psyche in the way that the Russian psychologist Alexei Leontiev, a German psychologist Klaus Holtzkamp, describe it as a series of developments where you get selections of particular, where you have actually two forms of catastrophes or catastrophes, one where you get a point of bifurcation, and the second one where you get transitions between two possible states at a particular point. So what you can have is, you can have a from a state where you just have, where you have only one state, you can get into a region through environmental pressures where you have two relations, and you can have see the sign as exactly existing as that relation, that possibility of going back and forth. Why I like this model, this image, is the following. Some of you may be familiar with Lucy Sutchman's work on plan and situated actions, and we know that when you try to follow a recipe, instructions for something, there's a gap between the description that you read and understand and what you're actually doing. Now, this is not only when people learn to put together furniture or program a VCR. I have seen it among scientists. A scientist with 30 years of experience dissecting a fish eye in the morning, then conducting all day experiments with it, and in the evening he says, I don't think I have dissected this fish eye in the way I wanted. How can that be? And I'm thinking that there's a gap between the imminent knowing of doing dissection and the representation, I do it dissection, and what happens when I do this kind of dissection, which are very different, and they're separated by a gap, and this gap was sort of made thematic in Lucy Sutchman's plans and situated actions. And for me, I can visualize it as happening here, because you clearly have a gap between the two possible states. I show it more generally that this, and in fact in the literature, this approach has been used to show cognitive development. Waddington's work on speciation was shown to be modeled by Thom's chaos or catastrophe theoretic approach, and also people working in morphogenesis and anthropogenesis have used, for example, to show the coexistence of Homo neanderthaliensis and Homo sapiens, and what eventually made the selections, the differentiation that originally occurred, and then the selection that made Homo sapiens the dominant species. Okay. The doubling that occurs is actually required for intentionality. We cannot be even do a gesture unless the kind of schema that George and Raphael talk about, it does exist, unless we have an orienting point. So in order for intentionality to emerge, we cannot stay with knowing at an immanent level. We actually need some form of transcendent knowing, because otherwise we cannot orient toward intentionally, pre-doing the movement, plan to engage in the movement. And as a final comment, I think that the work of Mendigaran and Henri, for example, that locate knowing in the body, in the imminent execution of movements, ties up, can be shown to be consistent with Bourdieu's work on habitus. Actually, in French, they use habitus and habit that Mendigaran works out. And you can show a nice transition from Mendigaran, who seems to be focusing on the individual, and Bourdieu, who clearly focuses on the social. What is common and underlying to them, to that work, is some people prefer expressions like mutually constitutive relations. I just say materialist and dialectical forms of relation. We can show this the relevance of this work of gestures, for example, that are not prefaced by thought in the work of Kirsch and Maglio on the function of movement in the game of Tetris, where the movement actually is a way of structuring the perceptual field, and this structuring is so fast that it's of an order of magnitude faster than it would take for the Tetris player to interpret what he or she sees, then decide on next action, and then and act the next movement. And I also see, you can see Watson and Crick, when they developed their DNA model, what they did, they actually played with shape, and they were seeing the model before they were thinking the model. And I just found that Susan Golden Meadows takes up these ideas that gestures are not just expressions of pre-existing thought, but they are actually the leading edge of thought. They're actually, it is out of hand movements that thought will develop. And so I see that my own work, that connects with very different fields, that they describe phenomena that the others come to describe in different ways, but in internally consistent ways. And to finish, corporal knowledge is not a provisional knowledge, not a primitive knowledge, perhaps, but one that is rapidly surpassed by the intelligent human. It's rather, it's the primordial and irreducible knowledge on which everything else, all representation, is built. And I think what we need to do is we need to look for what is there before the sign, and how does that sign emerge? What is there before we know in representational forms that makes the representational forms possible? Once we show that, then people like the mathematicians can't come back and say, well, your gestures are just, you know, things that accompany the real thought of us mathematicians. And I think that is not being made strong enough. I don't think that others see it yet, that the body is really the place where it all starts. And that's where I wanted to contribute to. Thank you very much.